From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. This hour,
they do a lot of the worst work. And if they left all of a sudden, I don't know what would happen. It probably wouldn't be good.
An immigrant story in a place you might not expect. Today, we take you to the island of Puerto Rico. But we're also talking to Puerto Ricans on the mainland, including actress Rita Moreno.
You are so accustomed to being ignored and let's say, treated in an undignified way, that's the thing that always stays with you. I don't know why.
Life, love, and humility. And a little music from the amazing Calle 13, among other things, as we bring you our favorite stories from La Isla del Encanto. Coming up on Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. As a new year begins, we're listening back to some of our favorite pieces from La Isla del Encanto, Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is home to about 50 to 100,000 undocumented immigrants, almost entirely from the Dominican Republic. We take you to visit a U.S. border unlike any other. But to get to Puerto Rico, those immigrants had to cross it. Here's Latino USA producer Marlon Bishop.
The other border has no fence to divide it. There are no bridges to cross or checkpoints to be checked at. There's no desert to lose oneself in. The other border is a 60-mile stretch of ocean between the island of Hispaniola, shared by the Dominican Republic and Haiti, and the U.S. Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. It's called the Mona Passage, and those who know it fear it.
It can be nearly flat calm 1 minute, and then of 8 to 10 foot seas the next minute.
Coast Guard Captain Drew Pearson knows the Mona Passage as well as anybody. It's his job to patrol it.
And that can lead to a boat capsizing. That can lead to people being ejected into the water.
The Mona Passage is the main route for illegal immigration to Puerto Rico, mostly from the Dominican Republic. The migrants are brought over by smugglers in small wooden boats called yolas. Each boat can be packed with 100 people or more. It's dangerous, Captain Pearson says, and accidents happen.
Those smugglers don't care about them. They don't give a darn about them. All they want to do is get the money and deliver that load and go back and get another one. People need to not do that. They need to stay with their loved ones and figure out a legal way to get to where they want to be.
That may be easy for Captain Pearson to say, but those who choose to migrate see it differently. Puerto Rico is poorer than Mississippi, the poorest state, but it's still almost 5 times wealthier than the Dominican Republic. That means for many Dominicans, the chance to dramatically better their lives is worth the risk of drowning at sea.
Mi nombre es Altagracia Pablo. Soy de origen dominicano.
Meet domestic worker Altagracia Pablo. She lives in Santurce, a lively Dominican neighborhood in San Juan. 10 years ago, she left her mother and 2 young daughters in the DR and decided to trust her fate to the sea. Back home, Altagracia lived in deep poverty. Her house collapsed in a storm, and she and her family were left homeless. Then she made a decision. She borrowed $1,500 to pay the smugglers. They told her to pack a single change of clothes and brought her to Miches, a town on the eastern edge of the island. She vomited over and over again during the 28-hour journey. And that wasn't all. Water leaked into the gas supply, and there were problems with the motor. Under the relentless sun, tensions between passengers sizzled. Fights with knives and bottles broke out. But in the end, they made it to shore, safely and undetected.
Let's go over to the station.
If Altagracia had been caught by the authorities, she might have ended up here, at the Border Patrol station in Aguadilla, a few hours west of San Juan. This is where migrants who are apprehended are taken to get processed. Jeffrey Quinones, a communications officer for U.S. Customs and Border Protection, says Border Patrol recently marked 25 years in Puerto Rico.
I grew up in this side of the island, so I remember before the Border Patrol was here that YOLOs would just come through.
But over the years, enforcement has gotten stricter.
Well, the best analogy is to come to the door. You have to knock on the door and say who you are and say what's your purpose to coming in. If you come at a place that's not the door, that automatically makes it a crime punishable by immigration law.
While I'm here, a new group of migrants is brought in, just picked up from the sea.
At this point, they just arrived here at the station. We're at the south.
I speak with a Dominican man in handcuffs. I'll call Pedro. Pedro had lived undocumented in Puerto Rico for 11 years, working as a welder. One day, while he was playing dominoes outside with some friends, he was nabbed by immigration agents and sent back to the DR. Since being deported, he's tried to return to Puerto Rico 5 times. Each time, the boat turned back because of bad weather. Finally, this time, he made it across, but his vessel was caught by the Coast Guard. As a repeat migrant, he'll be prosecuted and could serve jail time. Considering everything, Pedro is insanely relaxed about the situation. He says you take a risk knowing you will either win or lose. Either way, amen. They're two sides of the same coin. Actually, most of the migrants at the station aren't Dominican. They're Haitian. And they're not relaxed at all. They look scared and exhausted as they wolf down plates of rice and beans. They're hesitant to talk to me, unsure of who to trust. Their presence reflects the changes in immigration patterns to Puerto Rico. Recently, fewer Dominicans are arriving as the Dominican economy improves. At the same time, there's been an explosion in Haitian migrants. In 2006, only 2 Haitians were apprehended by Border Patrol. Last year, the number was 600. I asked one of the migrants, a woman who could speak some Spanish, why she came.
Estamos sufriendo y pasamos mucha hambre con mis hijos.
We were suffering, she says. We were going hungry, my kids and I. Was it worse after the earthquake, I ask? Worse, she says.
Peor.
More and more, Haitians have been trying to reach Puerto Rico as the preferred option for escaping hardship and instability in their country. Whereas Dominicans generally try to reach the island undetected, boats carrying Haitian migrants usually try to get to one of the tiny outlying islands that are part of Puerto Rico. Once they arrive, they usually claim credible fear of returning to Haiti, and U.S. immigration authorities have generally been allowing them to stay and start asylum proceedings. Dominican migrants are theoretically able to claim credible fear as well, but for whatever reason, they have less success with it. Meanwhile, most migrant Haitians who reach Puerto Rico have been able to stay in the States, at least temporarily, if, that is, they can cross the Mona Passage alive. The Haitians who do make it find help from Father Olin Pierre, a Haitian priest in San Juan.
Es el papel primero de un sacerdote ayudar.
Father Olin says that helping the weak is the main duty of a priest, not to mention, they're his people. Puerto Rico has no system in place for dealing with Haitian arrivals, so Father Olin has taken up the slack and turned his church into a makeshift refugee camp. Now, whenever a new Haitian boat comes in, authorities take the migrants straight here. Cots are laid out along the floor of the rectory. Women cook a meal of seafood as the guys watch a DVD on a portable player. One of them is 27-year-old William Joseph.
The trip was not easy.
The waters were rough as they were approaching land, and the Dominican smuggler forced his passengers out of the boat so he could head back quickly. They would have to swim the rest of the way.
So some of us doesn't know how to swim, and I tried to save some of them too. In the end, we have 5 people missing.
5 of Joseph's companions drowned.
Pero ellos ya habían llegado. Estaba en la orilla.
They had already arrived, says Father Olin, shaking his head. They had a bright future. He trails off. Nobody knows how many migrant bodies lie at the bottom of the Mona Passage. Estimates vary, from single digits to the thousands.
Es como jugando lotería.
It's like playing the lottery, says Father Olin. For the winners who make it to Puerto Rico and onto his church, life in the continental U.S. is so close they can touch it. Father Olin raises money from his congregation to buy them tickets to Miami or New York, where family members await. Almost no one stays in Puerto Rico. Meanwhile, the majority of Dominican migrants, who lack the open asylum claims of the Haitians, cannot just zip off to the mainland. Many try. Flights to the mainland are considered domestic, so Dominican migrants just need a fake ID to get on a plane. But it's risky. The majority choose to remain in Puerto Rico. Journalist Carmelo Ruiz says the island completely relies on the Dominican community to function.
I mean, it's the same dynamic with immigrants in the United States. They do a lot of the worst work. And if they left all of a sudden, who's going to fix my car? Who's going to mow the lawn? Who's going to work in agriculture? Who's going to do construction? Who's going to do this? I don't know what would happen. It probably wouldn't be good.
But immigration in Puerto Rico doesn't seem to stir up as much controversy as on the mainland. Here's Jeffrey Quinones from U.S. Customs and Border Protection about how average Puerto Ricans feel about undocumented Dominicans living there.
In Puerto Rico, illegal immigration, it's not necessarily an issue of public concern. Mm-hmm. There's no sense that there's a conflict mm-hmm. about their presence in the country.
He thinks it's because Puerto Ricans and Dominicans share a similar culture, food, music, language. Kelvis Polo, the owner of a discount clothing shop in San Juan, agrees. The presence of the Dominicans just isn't a big deal.
En todos los pueblos, en todas las razas étnicas, siempre va a haber personas que son racistas, otras no. Pero realmente no se ve eso.
Everywhere you'll find a few people who are racist, he says. You don't really see much of that here. You see it more in the States. Still, others I spoke to paint a more nuanced picture. Dominicans are the butts of a lot of jokes, and you might hear Puerto Ricans complaining about Dominicans moving into the neighborhood. And with no legal recourse to turn to, labor abuses are common. Domestic worker Altagracia Pablo says employers sometimes try to take advantage of her and try to make her do more work than she's paid for. That kind of unfair treatment can make her pine for home. But overall, she says, life in Puerto Rico has been good to her. My dream isn't to go back to the Dominican Republic, she says. It's to pledge allegiance to this flag, to the United States. Truthfully, she says, Puerto Rico, I love you. For Latino USA, I'm Marlon Bishop.
Since we first aired this report in March, we checked in with the Border Patrol to get the latest numbers. Just as in 2013, Haitians are still the majority of undocumented migrants, 75%, who are caught coming to Puerto Rico. Coming up on Latino USA, Residente of Calle 13. On Puerto Rico's politics. Sé que mis rimas a veces causan disgusto cuando mis neuronas corren hasta yo mismo me asusto. Mi respuesta puede.
Here you have a guy because of his political beliefs in prison for 32 years. It's crazy.
Puerto Rican hip hop pushing the limits. That's coming up. No se vayan.
Te fracturo, te lesiono y en la siguiente te resucito cuando te menciono. Eso es parte de mi arte, que todo el mundo sepa que estas rimas son para ti sin tener que mencionarte. Y no lo hago para evitar el roce, lo hago para no hacerte famoso en los países donde nadie te conoce. Después de ver cómo se mueven las guerras y la guerrilla, ¿tú crees que le voy a tener miedo a tu pandilla? Dispara cuando quieras, raperito maleantoso. Aquí no gana el más maleante, gana el más ingenioso.
Yo mantengo. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And now, a conversation with an artist known for pushing all sorts of limits, even sometimes of good taste. Esto va suave, sabe bien suave, 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 sabe bien suave. Esto va suave, quiere un poco de cazabe pa' ver cómo sabe. Aunque no quepa, métele con pepa. De pura cepa le someto a cualquier... Calle 13 began life as a group of potty-mouth jokesters out of Puerto Rico. They got a lot of attention for their alternative take on reggaeton music, full of over-the-top sexual humor. Since then, a lot has changed for the group. Over the course of their next three albums, Calle 13's music became more politically engaged, addressing issues like social justice and poverty in Latin America. Soy lo que dejaron, soy toda la sobra de lo que se robaron. Un pueblo escondido en la cima, mi piel es de cuero, por eso aguanta cualquier clima. Musically, they dropped their reggaeton roots and began making tracks that drew on all kinds of sources. Rock, funk, rap, and especially pan-Latin American folk sounds. Now, Calle 13 is especially beloved by university students and young activists all over Latin America. Todo empieza con una llamarada cuando despedimos llamas de nuestras miradas. Last year, the band released its fifth studio album titled Multiviral. The music is still funny at times, political at others, but more than anything, Multiviral is Calle 13's most introspective album yet, and it frequently addresses the big questions about what we're doing here on planet Earth. To hear a little bit more about their new album, we were joined in the studio by René Pérez Joglar, also known as Residente, the group's rapper, lyricist, and fiery frontman. René, it's great to have you on Latino USA.
Thank you.
So, René, 9 years later, Calle 13 basically has developed a reputation as a group that, I mean, essentially does what it wants, that, you know, you're anti-conformist, you basically defy authority whenever you can. So, René, would you say that you are, in fact, all about pushing boundaries? Is that how you see yourself as an artist?
I think that I like to make the people question themselves about everything, because that's the way I am. I don't know, I have too many questions, and I just work with that.
Philosophical question, existential questions, life questions.
Yeah, and stupid questions, like normal, regular questions. Like for this album, the new album, it was more like a reflection. Like I had more time to think about everything, and it's more existential, I think.
Do you remember the first time that you read Eduardo Galeano?
The first book that I read about him was Las Venas Abiertas, that a friend of mine gave it to me.
So the open veins of Latin America.
Yeah, the open veins of Latin America. And actually, I didn't finish it. I'm not a good reader. Like a lot of people think that I'm always reading, and I have ADD, so I have like attention deficit disorder. So what I like about Galeano is that I can read his short stories, and he's not pretentious, and I have fun reading him.
So it's probably the first time that Eduardo Galeano was actually put to music, and it sounds extraordinary.
Oriol Val, que se ocupa de los recién nacidos en un hospital de Barcelona, dice que el primer gesto humano es el abrazo. Después de salir al mundo...
We are a big fan of Eduardo Galeano's too, and one of the things that I love about putting him on our show is his voice and his timbre. And in that story that he tells, every time that I hear it, I'm like almost moved to tears. It's a story about the simplicity of life and death. Why did you decide to include Eduardo reading this story in your new album?
He has a great voice to record. And yeah, and I invited him. We met here in New York and we drank and we had a good time. And then he did it in Uruguay. Yeah.
When people say that you and the Calle 13 have become a very political band, doing things like putting a political writer and a poet, you know, what's your response to that?
It's just like a normal human being trying to write things that are happening, social stuff, because we are surrounded by social things. So that's the way I write. But they try to put stamps on you, like revolutionary, or it's more simple, you know.
Well, what is the simplicity then of your message?
I think it's a documentation. It's like a documentary of what is happening right now. And you just have to look around, and it's like drawing something that you're looking the same way you're doing when you're writing and when you're making music.
So on your new album, Multiviral, there's this standout track called El Aguante, which, you know, what's the translation? Put up with? Resist?
The resistance, or, yeah.
I love that song.
Yeah, me too.
I love that song. Lo que viene, aguantamos aunque tengamos los segundos contados. Nuestro cuerpo aguanta hasta 15 minutos ahorcado. Aguantamos latigazos que nos corten los dos brazos. Fracturas en cualquier hueso. 3 semanas con un yeso. It's really a song about celebrating life, even though you're saying resist. It's celebrating life.
The idea started out because of the music. My brother was doing like an Irish kind of folkloric music. And yeah, I was thinking about my friends in Ireland, like the way they drink and they resist. They don't get drunk. So that's why I start writing about how much our body resists different things, and then the history, historically, how much human beings, you know, have resisted everything.
It's incredibly hopeful, the song. On the other side of that, you have a song that is not Aguante, it's Adentro. And of course, there's this very famous video, right, in which you, René, actually destroy the Maserati that you had bought, and you destroy it with a baseball bat, and then you send it over a cliff. Which, of course, when somebody told me that you had a Maserati, I was like, no, it couldn't have been.
Yeah, a lot of people, they didn't know that, because I bought it like a long time ago. And then like 3 months later, I thought that it was very stupid and I felt wrong. And then I start traveling and knowing different part of the world. And I thought, man, I don't want to use this car anymore. So I just destroyed the car.
You literally just destroyed the car, and we saw it in the video. Just a little bit now about Puerto Rico. You are firmly rooted in the Puerto Rican experience. You are firmly rooted in your political experience of wanting independence for Puerto Rico. And you just did this recently in a concert in Mexico. You asked everybody to know more about Oscar López Rivera. So even though you may have this very worldwide writing of your music, there are many things that you want very specifically people to understand about Puerto Rico. And one of them is the fact that there are political prisoners.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you have Oscar López Rivera, that he's like 32 years in prison. You know, they talk that this is the land of the free. And if you do that in Latin America, I know that in CNN they're going to talk about, oh, look, those countries with those dictators and everything. And here you have a guy, because of his political beliefs, in prison for 32 years. It's crazy.
Do you think that most people who know your music actually know and understand the politics of Puerto Rico? Or
it's difficult to know about a country if you didn't grow up there, you know? I try to avoid any political things outside Puerto Rico and the U.S. Both are my countries, even though I want to be independent, but we are part of the U.S., sadly. Not because I don't like the people from here, but just because I want to be like the people from here, with one flag and free.
Conocedor de múltiples maniobras, el viejo en la mezcla de lo mejor de las obras, el mundo explotó y quedó desierto, y el viejo heredó lo mejor.
Finally, there is a wonderful song, one of the highlights of your album, Así de Grandes Son Las Ideas. And it's just so poetic.
A sangre fría opera todos los momentos. Todos los minutos que se pierden por ahí los puede recuperar con un bisturí. Estira los segundos para que se hagan más largos. También hace trasplantes de momentos amargos. Y si continúa la amargura.
What is for you the power of ideas?
Yeah, ideas. An idea is everything right now. Like you can live or you can die because of ideas. This song is about an idea that never died. And the idea want to die, and it tries to commit suicide to give space to new ideas. But, yeah.
Well, for all of your ideas, René, residente of Calle 13, thank you so much. Your ideas and your music are very powerful and mean a lot to all of us at Latino USA.
Thank you.
Se hacen eternas cuando las quieren y siempre viven y nunca mueren. Cuando se duermen son indefensas y se despiertan cuando las piensas y las atan.
René Pérez Joglar, or Residente, is one half of the group Calle 13. Their album is Multiviral. And for more on the music we played in this segment, stop by latinousa.org.
Y se despiertan cuando las piensas y las atacan y las defienden. Las más valiosas nunca se venden. Alcanzan todo lo que deseas. Así de grandes son las ideas. Se hacen eternas cuando las quieren. Y siempre viven y nunca mueren. Cuando se duermen son indefensas. Y se despiertan cuando las piensas y las atacan y las defienden. Las más valiosas nunca se venden. Alcanzan todo lo que deseas. Así de grandes son las ideas.
And now, bringing a bit of Puerto Rico north to Holyoke, Massachusetts, where there's a space in a middle school that doubles as a rainforest, just like the kind you'd find in Puerto Rico. Island expats have been coming to Holyoke for decades, but for the youngest Boricuas, this classroom is the closest they might get to their ancestral home. Karen Brown has our story.
Outside the windows of Peck Middle School, you can still see a few muddy piles of snow left over from this year's endless New England winter. But inside one second floor classroom, it's warm, moist, and green.
Okay, come on, kids. You can go inside.
Amid leafy green rows of tropical plants, you hear the sounds of falling water, the songs of wind chimes, and the chirping of a coqui, a tiny tree frog native to Puerto Rico. Okay, the coqui is on CD, but the plants are real, more than 300 of them, from avocado and cilantro to coffee and sweet potatoes to green bananas and a brilliant red flame tree.
This is the flamboyant, but most of the picture you see from Puerto Rico got the flamboyant on it. So this is the C, the little C is right here. This is the flamboyant.
School outreach worker Gerardo Munoz, a Puerto Rican transplant himself, created this mini rainforest from seeds he'd been cultivating at home for years.
Some people bring me to me, the secretary bring me some different seeds. You got a lot of family, they send me.
Last fall, Munoz began to bring his plants into the classroom. He added a heater and a couple fountains. He calls this space El Yunque, after Puerto Rico's national rainforest.
We see the pineapple here. And then a mango, lemon here. This is que son lo que es mapping.
Holyoke's roots are Irish, and to pay respect, Munoz tucked a few leprechauns among the guava. But today, Puerto Ricans make up half the population. Munoz says he wanted to give new arrivals a way to hold on to their culture and climate. And he wanted those with more distant connections to learn about their origins. And there's one more thing. Munoz, who's 48, is struggling with serious health issues, he hopes to leave a legacy to the kids, including his own teenage son, who came to the mainland at age 4.
He never go back to Puerto Rico, so I have to teach him this is the orange, this is that. Because, and the same thing I do with my kid, I want to do with the other student.
But there's more to El Yunque than an enhanced botany lesson.
This is a school that has too many kids with behavior problems. They come into here, you know, to calm down, to de-escalate the kid.
It's beautiful here.
Bralian is a 13-year-old who recently arrived from Puerto Rico. Sometimes she gets into fights with other girls in her class. When that happens, she's sent to El Yunque, and she says it settles her. Her teacher, Digna Hernandez, helps translate.
Because he looks like Puerto Rico, and also, you know, she can think about that, you know, when she was there, and also it's peaceful and calm.
Some kids end up here on their own. School counselor Ida Ortiz says it's not uncommon for students to get agitated and disappear from their regular classroom, only to be found in the rainforest.
And they said, when I go there, when I have a problem with the teacher, I escape to that room, and it makes me feel better. But, you know, even adults here, they come and breathe, counting me.
Including you?
Including me.
Counselors use the classroom for therapy, and even Massachusetts Social Service Agency has gotten wind of its soothing properties. Social workers who come to investigate potential child abuse interview kids in El Yunque. Munoz says that's because the kids often feel too scared to talk in a regular office.
When they come into here, they start looking all everything, you know, everything around, look at the electric butterfly over there, and then, you know, the social worker got more opportunity to ask him something because they don't feel afraid of anything.
Some social workers have even given Munoz personal donations for the garden. With that money, he bought a statue of an angel.
This is an angel for the kid.
In his own way, Munoz is another angel for the kids. He buys most of the gardening supplies himself and tends to the plants on his own time. That's not just for the students' sake, but for his own. He tells me why as I'm leaving.
I got a terminal problem. I will be maybe there in 2 years or 3 years, who knows? I got cancer. But he said, oh, come on.
Wait, you have cancer?
Yeah, I got cancer.
There are times, Munoz says, when he starts the day in chemotherapy and ends it under the lush green canopy of El Yunque. If one day he's no longer around to teach the kids about their native island, he's hoping the living, growing plants will do it for him. For Latino USA, I'm Karen Brown in Holyoke, Massachusetts.
And you still don't know. He is one of them!
No, Anita.
Yes!
A boy like that would kill your brother. Forget that boy and find another. One of your own kind. Stick to your own kind.
Coming up on Latino USA.
I really believed in romance, which was, you know, a big mistake.
The great Rita Moreno on life, love, humility, and so much more. That's coming up. Stay with us.
A boy who kills cannot love. A boy who kills has no heart. And he's the boy who gets your love and gets your heart. Very smart, Maria, very smart. A boy like that wants one thing only. And when he's done, he'll leave you lonely. He'll murder your love. He murdered mine.
Una vieja se vistió con un enagua cancan porque iba para San Juan. San Juan no llegó. Ya verá lo que pasó con la vieja en el camino. Que de pronto un remolino de viento la levantó y a otro pueblo la tiró como un grano de comino.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. For many Latinos, the first person they saw in mainstream American culture who looked like them was actress Rita Moreno. Between her role in West Side Story and her time as a cast member on The Electric Company, she was a representative to more than one generation of Latinos. In fact, when I first saw West Side Story in the 1970s, it was a revelation. For a little Mexican girl on the south side of Chicago, this movie with a beautiful girl named Maria was life-changing, even if she was played by Natalie Wood. But Rita Moreno stole the movie with her portrayal of Anita, and she became the first Latina to ever win an Academy Award for that performance. I'm so pleased to bring you my conversation with actress and American icon Rita Moreno, in which we discussed her memoir. You know, Rita, I have met you on other occasions, but honestly, to have you sitting down with me for a full
interview,
because we've been trying to do this for a while.
Oh, about 10 years. So I'm delighted to be here.
In your trajectory, and as you say, you have been now receiving many Lifetime Achievement Awards.
I was saying it's become a cottage industry.
But you are pretty amazing. I mean, you have an extraordinary career as an American actress. So we want to applaud you. I mean, that's a wonderful thing, no?
Oh, yes. No, I'm not complaining. It's just that I think of myself in such a different way than you would think an actor thinks of himself. I'm still that little Puerto Rican girl. It's true. When something really major like this happens, I really literally go right back to Puerto Rico and being on the boat and coming to this country with my mom. It's really difficult for me to see myself in the position of this person that they're honoring.
Still.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What is it about Latinas? Because we kind of do this thing, which is just like, you know, we're like, me? Really? What? Me?
It's true. I mean, my daughter is always amazed when I'm amazed. She said, well, why not, Mom? And I said, well, I suppose. But it's always a reluctant kind of acceptance. I guess, you know, I think you get traumatized in a way. You are so accustomed to being ignored and let's say, treated in an undignified way that's the thing that always stays with you. I don't know why. I mean, I've had a remarkable life to be honored now for, like, the Screen Actors Guild Lifetime Achievement as a lifetime of specialness. That really knocked me out. It's not getting an award for a performance in a film or a television show. It's being honored and recognized and acknowledged for a life. And that's staggering. I mean, come on. Let's be honest. Wouldn't you be staggered?
I think I would be staggered. But what's staggering to me is the fact that the place that you go back to is the boat.
Yeah.
And when I was reading about you, mm-hmm. and the fact that you have written about that boat ride, I mean, most people think New York, I mean, Puerto Rico, New York, you were on a plane. You were on a boat.
I was on a ship called the SS Carabobo, which is hilarious.
You're kidding me, Carabobo.
No, that's what's so funny. If you read the book, it'll say, you know, Carabobo. Well, Carabobo literally means stupid face, dumb face. And for, you know, I think that's not a good portent for what's to come in this new life I'm supposed to have. Why in God's name would anyone name a ship stupid face?
Well, you laugh about it now, but the way you write about it, because you write in such detail about how harrowing it was. So describe for our listeners. Yeah. What was this trip from Puerto Rico where you had this idyllic childhood, you know, literally that idyllic, like jumping around in the jungle with the frogs and the butterflies, literally. And then you get on this ship.
And I get on this ship and there's a horrendous storm at sea. as I like to say, you know, Puerto Ricans are known for many things, you know, their vivacity, their capacity for joy, their musical sense. But I think the thing for which we take the greatest honor is panicking. I mean, you have Puerto Ricans who can't swim because, you know, nobody swims in Puerto Rico. That's for the tourists or the people who, you know, do special fishing things. But nobody swims there. So here you have all of these Puerto Ricans going bananas because the ship is behaving like a cork at sea and getting sick to their stomachs and all that kind of stuff. Ay, Dios mío, me voy a morir este condenado bote.
You remember, it's like you remember hearing those voices, those screams.
I remember the screams I hear. I remember people weeping and wailing and being ill. I mean, a lot of people got very, very sick on that trip. And, you know, cursing the day they ever thought that they should go to this so-called wonderful new life. So it's very vivid in my memory.
So why do you think that we go to this place? Because you said that after... that Latinas, speaking about our identity, that we are so accustomed to being set aside or overlooked or treated badly.
Success is a lot more accessible now. It was almost impossible then and almost laughable that you would even try then. So I think that's a part of my youth that has stayed with me. It's very stubborn and it stays there.
So is the part of the youth that stays with you the part that says, there's not a place for me here, but I'm going to try anyway because I've got this thing in my gut?
Absolutely. For sure. For sure. And, you know, also to this day, and I have a feeling this happens with a lot of people, they just don't know how to deal with it or what to name it. I call it the negative little child in me who still says, by the way, ha, ha, I knew you couldn't do it. I knew, really, she exists in me. This is Rosita Dolores. That's me as a child saying, this is not going to happen. Are you serious? You don't deserve this. You haven't earned this. That's still very much there. The way in which I deal with this this bad kid in me is to send her to her room. You know, say, go to your room.
Y te calles la boca.
And shut up. Shut up in your face, as my mom would say. But she does exist in me, and I think she exists. That kind of presence exists in a lot of people. They just don't. They just think it's a part of them that's much a part of the conscious mind. I don't think it's conscious at all. I think it comes from another place and another time, and she hangs around. I was a very sensitive child. I can say all of this now in retrospect because I didn't know this for years about myself. And I was in therapy for years and a very successful therapy, I feel.
So how old were you when you went into therapy?
I was in my early 20s. And it was Marlon Brando who said, you need help. Marlon Brando's telling me I need help, right?
You're one of the few people who has
this lunatic colossus. But he was right. He had seen me on television one day doing a local show, just being me. And he said, that's not you at all. I don't know. I didn't know who you were. He said, you need to find out who you are. And he's the guy really who ultimately helped me find myself, despite this horrendous relationship that we had.
Well, no, I mean, the fact that you can talk about a relationship with Marlon Brando when Marlon Brando was Marlon Brando is still a little jaw-dropping, you know.
He was jaw-dropping. He was gorgeous. He was powerful. He was handsome. He looked like a Roman coin, for Pete's sake.
He really did.
Yeah,
I mean, when
did.
I think of those photographs.
And he was one, at that point, he was one of the brightest, most intelligent, most well-informed people, men, I had ever met in my life. So there was a lot to attract me, aside from the usual, you know, animal magnetism that occurred with him. But also, I was very young for my age, always was. And I really believed in romance, which was, you know, a big mistake. I was very Latina. I was mad about him, but I was also, to be very honest, mad about the power that came with being with him. When I was with Marlon Brando, I was somebody. And that really, really screwed up that relationship, aside from the fact that he was, you know, truly a very complicated, crazy neurotic man. I found myself being somebody only when I was with him.
You write about when you were in Hollywood, the fact that you would look at the other starlets and you would say, I'm the wrong color. You actually would look at them and just say, there's something wrong with my skin color?
Absolutely. I absolutely believed. I always saw myself as darker than I was, for instance. And the crazy thing is that all I could see was fairness and blue eyes and how easy it was for them, or so it seemed. You know, the fact that probably they were just as neurotic as I in their own way is beside the point. I didn't perceive it that way. But you also have to remember that when I was a child, I had terrible confrontations with the other kids who called me terrible names. From the time I couldn't even speak English, and kids were calling me spick. But even when I didn't speak English and they said names like that at me, I knew something was wrong with me, even though I didn't know English, because it happened so often. I was 5. I was 6. I was in kindergarten. And right away, I knew that something was wrong with me. And of course, I never told my mom about this. I never told her about other episodes in my young life when kids were calling me terrible names. That's something I never brought home, because I really felt that it would hurt her so much, and that she couldn't, there was nothing she could do about it. Nothing I could do about it.
It wasn't the American dream that she was hoping for.
Hell no. Absolutely not. Now, here's what happened after West Side Story, which was so touching to me. Do you remember Liz Torres? Who was a...
Of course I know Liz Torres.
Yeah, she's a wonderful, wonderful woman. She said, I have to tell you a story about Oscar night when you won the award. And she said, you know, as you know, as a Latina, you know that the barrio is a very raucous place. We yell and talk and we laugh very loud, which is true. That's me. I am a raucous Latina. I cry hard. I laugh hard. It's all very, very emotional. So she said, on Oscar night, as usual, see, the windows were all open because it was a hot night in the barrio. And she said, you could see here, all of the TV sets were on for the Oscars, because obviously one of us was maybe going to win, or maybe not, but she was going to be announced. And she said, it was noisy until Rock Hudson went on for the best featured supporting actress. And she said that entire neighborhood turned to dead silence. She says she remembers thinking, wow, they're really paying attention. And when Rock Hudson announced my name, there was such screaming and yelling, going to the windows, which were open anyway, and she did it, coño, se la comió, wow, she did it. And I started to cry when she told me the story. And I said to Liz, you know what they were really saying? We did it. We did it. And that inspired a lot of people who are now, you know, rather big stars. I know that Jennifer Lopez is certainly one of them, Rosie Perez. Because now I'm known as La Pionera, which still makes me laugh because I don't see myself that way.
As a pioneer, really?
Well.
My gosh, you were a pioneer.
I get ultra modest. And I always get very shy when people say things like that to me. And yes, they do say things like that. And yes, I do immensely appreciate their telling me that. The last one was Kerry Washington. Kerry Washington, who I met recently, this beautiful young woman, and she grabbed me and hugged me, and she says, you have no idea how much you mean to me. And I'm looking at her, you know, with these huge eyes. I'm suddenly, you know, 10 years old again. And I'm saying, you do? And she said, of course I do. What do you mean, do? She said, absolutely. She said, you mean? And she went on and on about, you inspired me and all that. I met Amy Poehler at the same thing. Amy Poehler, who says, oh, my God, I love you. And I'm staring at her and saying, You love me?
She said, of course I love you. You're wonderful.
It absolutely takes me by the most profound surprise.
And that's really what you want to hand down to the next generation, right? Which is
absolutely
no matter how it looks on the outside, most people on the inside are terrified, and you just got to.
It's one of the reasons I wrote this book, because when people start talking about the Marlon Brando part of it and the Elvis Presley part of it and call it juicy, I think what they miss is that I felt it was very important. He played a huge part in my life, a huge part. He changed my life in so many ways. Most for the worse, but some for the better. And I can't not do my life without including him. It's a huge part of 8 years, on and off, the tempestuous, obsessive relationship. And I deliberately wrote that as honestly as I could because I wanted women to understand that they're not alone, that I, too, like many others, wanted to please this one man and would do anything for him, and that one can somehow get over this. It was very important to me to talk to the woman who's reading this. And it saddens me that people think it's just, you know, meant to be juicy. It was even the Elvis Presley part, which is kind of hilarious because I wanted to make Marlon jealous and Elvis wanted to meet me. So what better guy? Two kings.
Oh, God. That's just like crazy.
It is. It's bizarre. That's why that's mentioned. I went into great detail about Marla for that reason.
I have always seen you as just incredibly positive and definitely one of the women who I would say is the queen of never giving up.
Well, that's why I wrote the book too, though. I wanted to let people know it's never quite the way it looks. Never, ever. And that it happens to the best of us and to the worst of us. And I wanted them to take heart from that, that too can pass.
Rita Moreno, do you sleep well at night?
You bet your ass, yes. Thank you. Thank you. I'm sure they'll censor me, but...
And that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our intern is Laura Calzada. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And I'll see you on my Instagram. Y felicidades y feliz año nuevo. Happy New Year, everyone.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. And by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. And the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security at carnegie.org. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
This lady with the blue veil, get that child out of here, she's mad.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all, on the web at rwjf.org. And Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income DC area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information at newfuturesdc.org. This is NPR.